She snuggled up next to him, and he put his arm around her, smiling as he recalled the way she'd flung that trash onto the ground, tripping up those three thugs, then recovered his gun. The next thing he knew, he was waking to the sound of a rooster crowing, the sun up, Remy already in the shower. The scent of cooked bacon greeted them as they joined Oliver at the breakfast table in the conservatory. No word on my uncle, unfortunately, but Mrs. Beckett insists that we eat. I hope you slept well, he asked, his smile looking strained. Sometimes the farm noises can be distracting. Remy smiled. I loved hearing the sheep at sunrise. Probably not the rooster, Oliver asked. That, Sam said, we could have done without. Life in the country. You get used to it eventually. I know I should have noticed, but do you take coffee or tea in the morning? Coffee, they both said in unison. He handed Remy the silver pot, looked down at his plate of food, eyeing his scrambled eggs with distaste. I was quite hoping to hear something by now. I'm sure it won't be long, Sam said, trying to put on a positive face. The police in London are very competent. No doubt they're making headway even now. The housekeeper appeared, waiting quietly in the door until Oliver looked her way. Yes, Mrs. Beckett. Your sister rang. She's at the police station. They've found your uncle. He pushed his chair back, standing. Why wouldn't they have called here? He's not hurt, is he? Did Allegra say anything? She didn't, sir. Just that you should get there straight away. Thank you, Mrs. Beckett. He looked at Sam and Remy. Please, finish your breakfast. Actually, Sam said, we'll be glad to drive you. After everything that's happened, it might be a good idea to have extra sets of eyes and ears. Right you are. The three met out front, where Sam's rental car was waiting, the keys in the ignition. A gray-haired man walking with a pronounced limp approached from a door in the side of the garage, nodding at them as Oliver made the introduction. Thank you, Jones. Sir? Oliver gave an embarrassed smile as he watched the elder man walk off. It's all very formal around here. Sir this, my lord that. Something I'm no longer used to. Uncle Albert hates it. Every one of these people here are like family to him, and he can't figure out why they insist on all the formalities. Sam slipped in behind the wheel, Remy taking the back seat, leaving the front for Oliver. He mentioned that at dinner our first night. In truth, we really can't afford the handful of staff remaining, but my uncle couldn't bear to let them go. They have nowhere else. Allegra's son even lived here for a few years when she was going through her divorce. Nasty business, that. How many staff are left? Remy asked from the back seat. Three families here in the manor cottages, not including the four farmers. The drive into Manchester took about 25 minutes, during which Sam was glad to see they hadn't been followed. At the station, Oliver nodded toward a woman standing out front, her light brown hair pulled back in a ponytail. My sister Allegra, he said. The moment she saw him, she walked over, her blue paisley dress fluttering in the wind. Where have you been? She asked. I rang at least an hour ago. I came as soon as I heard. Well, not soon enough. Uncle Albert's been arrested. What? When? Whatever for? Sometime early this morning. They're accusing him of insurance fraud for stealing the Grey Ghost. Preposterous. There is no insurance. Allegra looked at Oliver as though he had lost his mind. You didn't have the car insured? Apparently something happened, because their records show that we cancelled the appointment for them to come out and look at the car. They never drew up a policy. The last time it was insured was before World War II. That's not the worst of it, she said, drawing him toward the station. They're charging him with murder. Chapter 15. Oliver stared at his sister for several long seconds before turning to Sam and Remy. If you'll please excuse me, I need to find out what's going on. Like I said, maybe we should go with you, Sam said, just in case. I'm sorry. Who are you? Allegra asked. My friends, Oliver said. Sam and Remy Fargo. They're guests at Peyton Manor. Her brows went up a fraction. Not exactly the place to drag guests, Oliver. Is there even any furniture left? She smiled at them. Please, I'm sure. But if you'll excuse us, this is a family matter and we need to arrange for a solicitor. Actually, Sam said, we are family. His mother and Uncle Albert are cousins, Oliver said. He's Cousin Eunice's son. It's possible we can help, Sam added, if you can tell us what happened. She crossed her arms, her expression turning dark. He's in jail, arrested early this morning for murder. I'm not sure what else to tell you. Oliver's face turned pale. Did the police say who he was suspected of killing? Sam asked. Or where it happened? It was a warehouse fire, and the man who died was a security guard. A security guard? Murdered? Remy asked. She nodded. The firefighters found the body after they put out the blaze. They say he was one of the security guards from the London Motor Show. Sam looked at Remy, who was doing an admirable job of appearing very neutral. Probably she was thinking the same thing he was, that the man killed was someone involved in helping to get the car out of the showroom during the false fire alarm. And your uncle, Sam asked, where was he when all this happened? That's just it, I don't know. He says he has no memory of anything but driving off in the Grey Ghost. Oliver stared in shock. Finally, he shook himself, saying, Uncle Albert can't remember what he had for breakfast on a good day. How would he remember that? I have no idea. The police are preparing search warrants for his properties now. That doesn't make any sense, Oliver said. Why on earth would he be murdering a security guard, especially for a car he already owns? They're saying he did it for insurance, Allegra said. For the last time, the blasted car has no insurance. He didn't know that, did he? I have no idea. Even so, that's a far cry from murder. Where was this warehouse? Sam asked. London? No, here in Manchester, on Alberg Street. Oliver suddenly looked sick. Our warehouse? Uncle Albert's warehouse, yes. They're saying that he killed the security guard and set the fire as a distraction to steal the car. I still don't believe it. He could barely drive my car when he took it 2 weeks ago. I can't picture him trying to drive the ghost. And definitely not murder anyone. It was clear Oliver believed his uncle was innocent. But history was filled with stories of relatives being surprised how many proverbial skeletons were actually stuffed in the closets of their loved ones. And most police weren't likely to arrest without strong evidence. What proof do they have? Sam asked Allegra. It was several seconds before she answered. Video of Uncle Albert driving the Grey Ghost from the warehouse right before the fire. There was a camera mounted on the building across from it. I've asked to see the video, but they won't let me. They'll only show it to his lawyer, and he doesn't have one yet. Then we need to get him one right away, Oliver said. I'm working on it, Allegra said. But in order to hire him, we need money, which is why I need you. You have guardianship over Uncle Albert. With no money to speak of, the solicitor is asking for Peyton Manor as collateral. She pulled some papers and a pen from her purse. Where do I sign? Oliver, Sam said. Before you sign anything, let us at least get an attorney. If nothing else, to look over those papers. Well, I couldn't ask. We insist, Remy said. This is stressful enough without worrying about losing your home. He nodded. Thank you. You're probably right. Let's go in and see what the police have to say, Sam suggested. They learned little more than what Allegra told them. Since Oliver had power of attorney for his uncle, he at least was allowed a short visit while the others waited in the lobby. When he walked out several minutes later, he looked as bewildered as he had when he'd first learned the news. Allegra, who'd been pacing the entire time, stopped, looked at her brother. Well, she asked. Just as you said. The detective told me there's video of Uncle Albert climbing in the window of the warehouse just before the fire started in the office. A few minutes later, he's opening the garage doors and driving off in the Grey Ghost. See? Can we just sign the papers now and get him a solicitor? The thing is, Oliver said, almost as if he didn't hear her, how could he remember the location of a warehouse he hasn't been to in years, when he couldn't even find his way home that afternoon he wrecked my car? He wrecked your car? Allegra asked. Why am I only just learning about this? The point is, he couldn't find his way home from downtown Manchester to Peyton Manor. So how would he find his way to that warehouse from London? That's over 4 hours. Longer, even, when you consider the speed limitations of the Grey Ghost. Clearly, he didn't drive it. It had to have been in a truck. But who drove the truck? Oliver asked. The dead security guard? Uncle Albert only remembers waking up in the car. As expected, he can't recall where it is. Sam and Remy exchanged glances, Sam thinking that video evidence was pretty strong. Remy's expression was one of surprise mixed with disappointment, undoubtedly hoping for proof of the man's innocence, not his guilt. Remy tended to root for the underdog, and up until this moment, that had clearly been the case. Apparently she wasn't ready to give up, asking Oliver, after talking to him, what do you think? Only that he would never murder anyone. Allegra crossed her arms, her expression stern. Maybe not on purpose, but you have to admit, the insurance fraud. He still has moments when he's all there. Fewer and farther between. There is nothing you can say that'll let me believe he's guilty of any of this. The video, she said. Oliver's face fell, and he sank into a chair. Uncle Albert isn't a thief or a murderer. That's not how he taught me to live. And in those moments of lucidity, would a man intent on selling off the last of the family possessions to save his tenants resort to something like this? Remy nodded. He has a point. The problem is, Sam said, the police believe otherwise, or they wouldn't have arrested him. The investigators are looking for something more concrete than your belief that he's a man of character and worth, which gets you nowhere in court when faced with this sort of evidence. The most obvious, Oliver said, he couldn't possibly climb in that window on his own, and no way could he drive that car at night without his glasses. Probably not even with them. You heard what happened when he took my car. The mystery deepened, and Sam looked at Remy, noticing her brows go up almost imperceptibly. She was as intrigued as he. The way I see it, Remy said, it can't hurt to take a quick visit to that warehouse and have a look around. Chapter 16 Allegra looked aghast at Remy's announcement.
The warehouse? You think that's wise? In the midst of the police investigation?
We're only going to look. Should be safe enough if the police are there.
You can't be serious, Oliver, Allegra said. Think about it.
I trust Sam and Remy.
Well, I'll have no part of it.
She stuffed her papers back in her purse. If you're going to go off on this wild goose chase, someone needs to stay by the phone in case of emergency. She stalked off, clearly perturbed by their intentions.
She'll be fine, Oliver said.
A bit bossy ever since her divorce, and stressed from raising her son on her own. He stood.
Shall we?
The warehouse was located on the south side of town, surrounded by a sea of old brick warehouses constructed around the turn of the 20th century. The police had come and gone, as evident by the yellow crime scene tape pulled away and stuffed in a garbage can, its long ends fluttering in the breeze. Facing the street was the main entrance, a double door constructed of heavy corrugated iron. It was a massive affair, barely wide enough to allow a modern truck through. The doors were secured shut with a chain and massive padlock that looked strong enough to stop a locomotive. All the windows of the warehouse had been boarded up with plywood.
We should walk around the perimeter of the building, said Sam.
Quietly, almost afraid of making a sound, they walked through a century of trash and foliage, pausing to listen, but hearing nothing except an occasional chirping from a male bird trying to seduce a female. As they rounded the last corner, Sam thought he heard a scraping noise behind him. He drew his gun, motioning the others to be silent. But it was nothing, just a brief puff of wind blowing a branch of a tree against the building. Oliver eyed his weapon, looking mortified.
Is that really necessary?
I wish it wasn't, Sam said. Given their experience in London, he wasn't about to take any chances. He kept his gun down by his side.
What exactly are you looking for? Oliver asked.
Not sure yet. Something out of place.
hoping I'll recognize it when I see it. He paused in front of the building across the street, noticing a camera mounted near the roofline and pointed toward the Peyton warehouse. Who owns that place? Oliver looked in the direction of the camera.
I haven't the faintest.
Might be worth it to find out. He had to have climbed in one of these, Remy said, pointing to one of several boarded-up windows along the front. The others around back are too high. In fact, the lower part of the window frame was a little over waist high. He doesn't really have the upper body strength to pull himself up, Oliver said. Remy checked out the camera on the other building. Seems like an odd choice of entry for someone committing a crime. Sam walked over to the recessed door leading to the office. He motioned for Oliver and Remy into the protected area. He looked at Oliver. What did your uncle keep in this warehouse? Oliver shrugged. A few old cars and farm equipment he sold off when he needed the money. Any chance we can get inside?
Of course.
As Oliver pulled out his keys, a gunshot cracked, bits of brick hitting them. Sam stepped in front of Remy as she pulled Oliver next to her in the doorway. The gunman was somewhere to their left. Two more shots hit the wall beside them from the right. Remy, he called out, unable to spot the second shooter. We're fine. I came prepared. She already had her Sig Sauer drawn. He gripped his Smith & Wesson, scanning the street. Not trying to pressure you, Oliver, but we need in. Now.
One of these keys, Oliver said.
Sam kept his focus outward, gun aimed, as Oliver, hand shaking, worked at the lock on the warehouse door, unable to find the right key. They needed to move. Chapter 17 Oliver dropped the keys as several shots hit the building.
Remy? Got you covered, Sam.
She fired once in each direction as Sam gave the door a hard kick, but it didn't budge. Abruptly, Oliver pushed Sam aside, threw his shoulder against the door, and watched as the Fargo stared dumbstruck at seeing it swing open and crash against its hinge stops.
Where did you learn how to open doors like that? Asked Remy, highly impressed.
From 3 years on the Manchester Unified Soccer Team. Oliver was interrupted by a spray of shotgun pellets that ricocheted off the bricks beside Sam. Remy wasted no time raising her Sig Sauer, and she fired around the doorway but was unable to spot the gunman. Sam laid down a short barrage of fire at two targets he spotted on the roof of the building next door. Oliver threw his arms over his head at the crack of the gunshot, as shreds of brick cut tiny furrows in his forehead. Sam shielded Remy when she rammed against Oliver, propelling him through the open doorway. He emptied the Smith & Wesson at the gunman on the roof. One clutched his shoulder as he fell over the edge of the parapet. He was quickly dragged away by his companions. The office was black with soot, the floor still wet, everything reeking of charred wood. There was a second door leading into the warehouse that was also locked. Oliver threw his shoulder into it. The moment they were through, Sam slammed the door closed, Oliver pushing a heavy workbench against it. All were breathing heavily when Remy checked the men. The only injuries she found were the lacerations on Oliver's head. We need something heavier to block the door, Sam said, scanning the concrete floor. He spotted a rusty engine block hanging from a red hoist's chain and pulleys less than 50 feet away. Sam and Oliver, shoulder to shoulder, rolled the engine block on the hoist's overhead rail unit until it was hanging over the workbench. Oliver lowered the hoist's iron hook until the hunk of iron it was supporting thumped on the bench's surface, securely blocking the doorway. And none too soon. They heard footsteps in the office, then someone shouting, "Get that door open!" Sam spoke to Remy in a low voice.
"How many shots do you have left?"
"3. How about you?"
"Just reloaded," Sam whispered.
"Come closer to the door," came a gruff voice. "We can't hear you." Sam silently motioned for everyone back. Just as they moved farther away, hugging the concrete floor that reeked with rancid diesel oil, a deafening blast of automatic gunfire filled the warehouse. "Down!" Sam shouted, shielding Remy beneath him. Oliver froze, and Sam reached up and pulled him to the floor as another barrage of bullets ricocheted off the engine block. Lying on his stomach, safely below the spread of bullets, Sam looked around the warehouse and took stock. It was empty, except for two classic vehicles,
A dark green 1929 4.5-liter blower Bentley and a classic 1917 Aaron's Fox fire engine against the rear wall. Frozen in time, neither looked like their tires had rolled over a street in a century. They were parked side by side next to a metal tool cabinet and under three skylights coated with layers of soot and dust that only allowed a dim blanket of daylight to leak through to the interior of the warehouse. To their left, at the far end of the ancient building, stood the impassable corrugated iron doors, unfortunately secured on the outside with the huge chain and padlock. They saw no sign of another exit, or usable phone. He checked Remy, who seemed well composed, using her cell phone to call for help. Not so for Oliver, his skin tone ashen, a sheen of perspiration glistening on his forehead. Sam noticed he was cradling his right elbow, blood seeping through his fingers. Sam quickly pulled off Oliver's coat and saw a deep gash and led him to a seat behind one of the two desks, pushed together as a workbench. "Remy!" he shouted, seeing a stack of clean orange rags folded on the counter near a pegboard. "Toss me a couple." Remy grabbed several, bringing them to him. He folded one as a compress, pressing it against Oliver's arm, knotting two others together to hold it in place. At least it wasn't arterial. He'd survive, assuming they could escape. Whoever was out there wasn't worried about stealth, their heavy boots shuffling across the floor with whatever they were doing. A few seconds later, complete silence, and Sam hoped the men had given up. But then the strong scent of diesel reached them, the oil flowing under the door, pooling beneath the engine they'd used to block it. Suddenly they heard a new rippling sound, followed by a loud whoosh as a growing holocaust raced across the warehouse floor. Oliver reared back, fear bordering on panic.
"Fire! There's no escape!"
Remy ignored Oliver and calmly informed emergency services that the Peyton warehouse was on fire.
"Please hurry. Mr. Peyton is trapped inside. Please hurry," she repeated in her best uptight tone.
Sam grabbed the fire hose from the wall, hoping it was still connected to the outside water hydrant. He aimed at the blazing fire, opened the valve, and was rewarded with a lame spurt. Remy had pocketed her phone and grabbed an extinguisher from the rack on the wall. One twist with both hands and it broke off in a cloud of dust, along with an avalanche of mummified rat bones. Undeterred, she aimed at the fire. Nothing happened.
"Now what do we do?"
Oliver muttered, shrinking into the corner. Sam and Remy's eyes locked on each other for a moment, well aware they might never see tomorrow. In unison, they turned and stared at the old Aaron's Fox pumper fire engine. Chapter 18. Sam possessed a flair for creating a plan of action during the worst of times, and it took him no more than 10 seconds to calculate the odds. He held his focus, his eyes still locked on the big red fire engine. Not just any engine. It was an Aaron's Fox, the Rolls-Royce of firefighters. His childhood passion came flooding back as he remembered riding his bicycle to a fire station with his pals, helping the firemen polish their equipment in exchange for a free ride, with sirens shrieking, bell ringing. The firemen didn't call it a fire truck, but a pumper. The engine was a massive 4 cylinders behind the radiator, and a maze of valves and faucets mounted beneath a big nickel-plated ball that increased pressure enough that it could throw water onto the roof of a 40-story building. On occasion, the firemen would show the boys how to open certain valves so they could shoot water over a cornfield behind the station. As Sam recalled the events of 25 years ago, when he felt he had to work a complicated crossword puzzle in just minutes, he judged the distance from the pumper to the iron door, 80 feet for acceleration, then add the momentum and the weight of impact and deduct the drag of the flat tires. At best, it was a toss-up. Remy had found a piece of wire and was using it to tie her hair up in a ponytail. "Couldn't be worse," she said, with a grim smile thrown toward Sam. Black smoke was rising and flowing through the shattered skylights and becoming a cloud that soon spread and stained the sky outside. Burning debris from the rafters fell on everything, starting small fires. The heat was already unbearable, and their breathing was starting to come in painful gasps. "Oliver! Oliver!" Sam shouted. "Oliver!" But Oliver was lost in fear. He sat like a statue, his face ice white, eyes glazed, blankly staring at the blazing rafters ready to fall. Remy clapped her hands right in front of his eyes, trying to get his attention. Sam shook the man's shoulder. Oliver, the fire engine, does it run?
I don't know, he murmured. It should.
He seemed to stare right through Sam as he answered.
Got the Bentley running so we could sell it.
Why is it still hidden away in a warehouse?
Collectors claimed it had a replica body and too many flaws. They all refused to pay me, so I hid it away.
And the fire pumper?
My grandfather kept it in a building on the farm as a safety vehicle in case of fire in the buildings or the fields.
Sam looked at Remy with a look that belonged in a pickle jar. If we get out of here, we'll rewrite the book. Sam walked over to the grease pit that was sunk into a trench below the concrete floor. The flaming diesel was throwing up a torrid wall of fire like lava bursting from a volcanic eruption on the Big Island of Hawaii. Sam had no more patience.
What about the pumper? It's bigger and heavier to ram the doors.
Oliver continued to stare right through Sam.
The Bentley is faster. Couldn't sell it. The deal fell through. Must have some gas in its tank.
Sam ignored Oliver's mumbled reply, rushed over to the pumper and raised the hood. The gas valve was in plain sight. He checked to see if it was in the closed position as a safety measure in case the Aaron's Fox had sat for any length of time. He switched the lever to the on position and then checked to see if the battery showed any signs of life. There was a weak display of sparks when he tapped the two terminals together, but not nearly enough juice to turn the big four cylinders fast enough to cause combustion.
Is that it?
Remy asked, her voice slightly above a murmur through the clean shop rags she'd wrapped as a mask around her face to prevent her inhaling the acrid fumes.
How do you plan to start this thing?
At that moment, Sam felt the floor vibrate under his feet, seconds before the far section of the warehouse roof crashed to the concrete floor in an explosive typhoon that seemed like it was controlled by a madman. Faint sirens began to be heard over the deadly intensity, but by the time the firemen arrived, it would be too late. With every minute, death crept closer. The only bit of fortune that came their way was that the Aaron's Fox had been parked directly in front of the huge door, their only hope of escape. Remy was standing close to Sam, but spoke no more. She kept staring at those damned doors as if she could part them with her mind. Sam looked at Remy. Better you hop in the driver's seat than me. Remy stared back at Sam as if he was a tree stump.
What makes you think I can drive this old thing?
I have to start her from the outside. If I'm successful, I can get seated and launch the pumper in time to strike the door. Remy shook her head.
There must be another way.
If you don't listen to my instructions, he said hoarsely, we all die. She had never heard Sam speak to her with his voice so cold. A scowl crossed her face, but she said nothing. She knew this was no time to waste arguing with him when his mind was set. Every moment, fiery debris from above fell in a storm that came closer and closer to the ancient fire engine. Sam's eyes were set. Sweat was pouring down his face, yet there was no expression of fear. He looked into the eyes of his sweetheart and said, "Time to go. Take the seat behind the steering wheel. Oliver, get onto the fire truck." Oliver blindly tried to climb into the truck on his own. Sam gave him a boost, and he slid into the section behind Remy.
The lever on the left side of the steering wheel controls the ignition, Sam explained. Pull it down to its stop when the engine begins to turn over and fire. The right lever is the throttle. The top stop is the idle position. When it begins to start, jiggle it a few inches up and down to build up the revolutions per minute until the engine smooths out. Use it as you would a gas pedal on a car.
Next, he gave her a quick instruction on shifting the gears of the transmission.
How can I start it? Asked Remy. With a battery that's almost dead.
Sam held up a hand and produced a silver-plated crank.
This is how I have to start the engine. I'll take over when the engine fires up.
You'd better hurry it. Remy barely got the words out before the blaze surrounding the pumper began assaulting the tires that started hissing. Sam ran to the front of the truck and yelled back to Remy,
Ignition on!
On, Remy repeated in a choked voice. Sam remembered how to crank an ancient engine. He and his buddies used to drive the school majorettes onto the field before the football game in an old Model T Ford with no self-starter that had to be cranked by hand until the engine turned over and began running. He grabbed the crank by the handle, braced his arm, and heaved. The crank barely moved a quarter of a circle. Again. This time he managed to make a full swing as the oil began circulating inside the engine. The third pull came a little easier, but there was still no indication the engine was going to start. Sam looked up and saw flames dancing along the rafters and support beams overhead. Then, as he tightened his hand on the crank, he peered through the maze of pipes, pumps, and valves over the front of the radiator to see if Remy was still conscious and able to grip the steering wheel with one hand, with the other hand on the gear shift. Grim determination was etched on her lovely face. Sam lost track of the time as he turned the crank, but still no burst of exhaust. His arms were so numb he felt as if they had abandoned his body. He began to gasp more from the physical effort than from the fumes of the fire. After a few more spins of the crank, Sam was physically finished. Curiously, he was not conscious of the blisters rising on his hands. He sank to one knee, heart pounding, lungs heaving, vision fading, certain he could make only one more twist of the crank. He would crawl up to the seats and embrace Remy for one last time. Despite the turbulence, his body reeling, he heard her calling him. At first, his foggy mind dismissed it. Then he saw her waving at him over the windshield. He shouted that he was done in, but she shook her head and yelled back, "The engine turned over on the last crank. I'm not sure. I think I heard it pop from the muffler." Sam struggled to his feet and grabbed the crank handle, his final effort, urged on by his beloved soulmate. This time he swung the crank using both hands with the little strength he had left. There was a muffled pop out the exhaust pipe. Sam felt as if he entered another dimension. With renewed effort, he swung the crank again. This time the popping sound became a low growl as Remy pumped the gas pedal to raise the RPMs. The old engine coughed a few times and began to growl, then turned over smoothly without losing a beat. "I'll take it from here," Sam yelled to Remy above the crackling flames, now in tune with the crumbling walls of the warehouse. "Take the passenger seat and hunch down." The huge tires hissed as they rolled over the spreading pools of burning oil. No time to be clever. Sam aimed the big silver-plated globe in front on a straight course toward the huge iron barrier, put the truck into first gear, and mashed the gas pedal to the floor. The Aaron's Fox approached the iron barrier at a speed Sam didn't think possible. He gripped the steering wheel with one hand and threw an arm around Remy when the pumper was less than 5 feet from the massive doors. At almost the same instant of the collision, the entire roof and the two remaining walls collapsed in a black glow of whirling smoke. The pumper plunged into the great door with a horrendous crash that sounded like the burst of an explosive. The massive door refused to fall after the old vehicle came to an abrupt stop. Sam was surprised to see so much damage to the fire engine. Amazingly, it was still running, but the valves and pumps on the front end were a mangled mess. "Hit it again!" Remy shouted like a cheerleader at a college football game. Sam made no reply except to grind the transmission gear into reverse, backing up 50 feet before shifting into first gear. Crouched behind Sam, Oliver looked as if he was lost in a tunnel. Sam ignored the growing agony in his hands and tightened his grip on the steering wheel as he rammed the gas pedal into the floorboard. The engine rattled like it was about to blow apart, but it responded by leaping forward and smashing into the door. Agonizing seconds that seemed like a full minute passed, but nothing happened. Then slowly, incredibly slowly, the hinges began tearing away from the door frame where they had been welded. Shattered, they ripped away, the massive door seeming to hesitate, frozen in time before falling forward and crashing flat onto the cobblestone street with a great roar. Sam steered through the burning debris until they were in the clear and stopped under gushes of water from the fireman Remy had called. Taking deep breaths to clear their lungs, they climbed down to the street. "Now that was a close call, Fargo," Remy said. "You doubted us?" "Never us. The fire truck. An Aaron's Fox? How could you?" Sam took Remy in his arms, brushed the hair from her face, kissed her sooty forehead, backed away, holding out a little something he found, I believe this is yours. A souvenir to remember an exciting day. Remy's eyes widened as she reached behind her head, groping in her mussed hair for the little wire she had used to tie her ponytail. Sam passed it to her. I found it on the floorboard below the brake pedal. Remy put her arms around his neck and pulled him down to kiss him. I remember now why I married you. You're hopelessly sentimental. Chapter 19. Once the fire department had cleared what was left of the building and the police report made, without mentioning that Sam or Remy had shot back at the gunman, Sam watched as the investigator took photos of the door they'd escaped through. "You're lucky you got out," the officer said. "To be sure." Sam eyed what was left of the building. Had it not been for the antique fire engine, they would never have escaped. He looked over at the building where the camera was mounted, asking the investigator, "Any chance we can get a copy of that video?" "I'll check into it for you." Turned out that the camera was non-operational. A little too convenient in Sam's mind, especially considering the camera was working when it showed Oliver's uncle stealing the car. The next morning, at Peyton Manor, as the three sat around the breakfast table, Sam wondered why they'd been specifically targeted. Either someone was watching the place, or someone told them we were on our way there. "Nobody here would do that," Oliver said. "I trust my uncle's staff implicitly." He was looking a lot better than he had last night after they'd taken him to the hospital. The wound on his arm was deep and required a few stitches. Mostly he was suffering from shock, but after a good night's rest, he'd recovered sufficiently. They'd never do anything to hurt him. Well, someone knew we were there. The real question was, for how long? Whoever it was, they had the inside knowledge of Oliver's movements ever since Pebble Beach, possibly even before. "I think we're going to have to back up a few steps. We need to talk to that attorney Selma hired for your grandfather. If anyone can tell us what's going on with this case, he can." Sam called the number Selma had given to him on speakerphone. "David Cook's office," a woman answered. "Sam Fargo here, with Oliver Peyton. Is Mr. Cook available?" "One moment, please." Cook answered a minute later. "Glad you called," he said. "I've hired a top investigator for the case. Just heard back from him about that video the police have. According to his report, a couple of things of note. First, the white-haired man climbing in that window looks a bit too fit to be a 70-something-year-old with memory problems. More importantly, the video's grainy enough to be useless for a positive identification." "Which apparently didn't stop the police from arresting him," Sam said. "Because of all the other circumstantial evidence, including that the Viscount owns the warehouse where the murder took place. Whoever set him up put a lot of thought into it. Which brings me to my next point. The car show in London. The cameras worked up until the fire alarm sounded as the distraction to empty the convention hall. A little too convenient that suddenly there was a malfunction and no video exists of the theft. Also, the video from the days leading up to it were deleted." Sam and Remy exchanged glances. "Agreed," Sam said. "Too convenient. It gets even more interesting. The security guard who had access to the cameras? He's the chap found dead at the Manchester warehouse fire. Autopsy still pending." "Anything on him?" "Not yet. Scotland Yard's working on restoring the digital images leading up to the fire alarm. Unfortunately, that's all my investigator has so far." "That's a good start," Sam said. "Quite. I can tell you this much, though. It doesn't seem to be a crime of opportunity. My investigator informs me it seems to be a rather sophisticated operation. A lot went into the planning, even killing one of the men involved. In other words, Mr. Peyton needs to be careful, as does anyone around him." "We'll all be careful," Sam told him. "Thanks for the update." "That," Remy said as Sam disconnected the call, "certainly is troubling." Oliver's brow furrowed as he looked at Sam. "I have to wonder about the dead security guard. Why go to all the trouble to kill him? Just so Uncle Albert would be arrested?" If I had to guess, Sam replied, it was to make sure nothing led back to whoever's really behind this. You and I both know your uncle couldn't have done this on his own, which means that security guard was a loose end. Your uncle was a convenient target to throw suspicion. Oliver folded his napkin, set it on the table, pushed his plate away. Who would do this to him? He must be worried sick. At least the solicitor Selma hired as a decent investigator to help look into things, Remy said. We don't have to wait for the police to release the details. Sam checked his phone. Speaking of, text from Selma. He opened it, read it aloud. Rolls-Royce commissioned 2 demonstrator cars to be shown at the 1906 Olympia show. When the Grey Ghost was damaged, they replaced it with the unfinished Silver Ghost, which made its official debut in March of '07. Nothing else about the Grey Ghost? Remy asked. Looks like the Silver Ghost got all the attention after that. Prettier paint job? Remy said. That, and more press, Oliver added. The Grey Ghost was the one that suffered the hard knocks before they put the Silver Ghost through the trials. This is interesting, Sam said, scrolling through the text. There's no official record of the Grey Ghost. Selma says the chassis number you gave us, 60543, isn't registered. Every source she found shows that they skipped that number, which would have been on the 4th chassis. Sam looked up from his phone, eyeing Oliver. Know anything about that? As a matter of fact, yes. A rather unusual story, in fact. Chapter 20. Maybe more tragic than funny, Oliver began. Back in 1906, when the Grey Ghost was stolen, the current Viscount, being friends with Rolls and Royce, invested everything in their company. More specifically, in the development of the 4050. He was counting on the return on his investment to pull him out of the debt incurred by his nephew's gambling. Very much like my uncle's situation, he was worried about his tenants. And there was an orphanage he supported. And, well, the point is, he was counting on that car making the Olympia show to make him money. It's been a while since I read the history, and some of the details are fuzzy. Something to do with an American detective, Isaac Bell, from the Van Dorn Detective Agency, on the hunt for 2 men wanted in New York for bank robbery and murder. Thanks to Isaac Bell, the man and his gang were caught, and Bell was rewarded by the Crown for the recovery of the treasure. Well, part of it, at least. Exactly what did that have to do with the Grey Ghost? Sam asked. As I said, a bit of a tragic story, especially considering how it was this detective crossed paths with the Peyton Orens and the train robbers. Peyton Orens, Remy said. The former family name, before the 4th Viscount had a falling out with his younger brother. The older taking the name Peyton, the younger Oren, the 2 never talking again. Must have been some argument, Sam said. Over a woman, I believe. Though not as bad as what came later. Well, at least no one lost their life over it. In truth, it might be easier if you read about it yourselves rather than trying to glean anything from my faulty memory. The early Viscounts all kept a family journal. You think there's one from the time period when the Grey Ghost was stolen? Absolutely. I was duty-bound as the heir to learn family history. Some of the journals were rather dry. That one, however. Oliver stood. Let's have a look, shall we? He led them down the hall into the library, pausing in the doorway. I'll get the curtains. It's a bit dark in here. He crossed the room and pulled open the drapes, light spilling across a bare parquet floor into a room devoid of all furniture. Floor-to-ceiling shelves filled with books lined all 4 walls, however. My uncle couldn't bear to part with the books. Some have been in the family for centuries. Impressive collection, Remy said, examining a few. He smiled to himself as though remembering happier times, then walked up to one of the shelves, his fingers skimming over the spines of thin leather-bound volumes. Should be here somewhere. Odd, he said, looking on the shelf above it and the shelf below. I don't see it.
Sam joined him, searching through the volumes.
Maybe out of order?
They're numbered, he said. Volume 5 is missing.
Or misfiled, Remy said.
They started searching the shelves, though Sam doubted they'd find it. With everything that had happened to Oliver and his uncle so far, no doubt someone had taken that volume.
Any idea what was in it? Sam asked.
Read it a few times as a lad. Quite the writer, my ancestor. I dare say a few of his stories were worthy of being published. Less a journal, more like a novel. The story of that detective and how he rescued the Grey Ghost was as exciting to me as any modern-day superhero. But that was many years ago. Some of the finer details escaped me.
He stood there staring at the shelves, then pulled the slim volume out, handing it to Sam.
This might be a good one to start with. It's the journal right before the theft of the Grey Ghost.
He opened it, quickly turning through the pages until he was close to the end.
This is the next to last entry in this volume, and where I think it all started.
Chapter 21 Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Welswick, 1906.
Nearly a week after the ghost was stolen, Mr. Royce called me into his office and handed me an envelope, asking me to take it to the address given, then wait for an answer. My being sent on an errand wasn't unusual, and so no one seemed to notice when I took my overcoat and left. I looked at the envelope, saw it was addressed to a Mr. Isaac Bell at the Palatial Midland Hotel, the same establishment where Mr. Rolls and Mr. Royce first met when they decided to form Rolls-Royce Limited. When I arrived, I was met by a tall, blonde-haired, mustachioed man dressed all in white, who'd apparently been watching for me. I handed him the envelope. He opened it and read the missive, his eyes moving from the letter to me on occasion. When he finished reading, he tucked the letter and envelope into his breast pocket, telling me that his answer was yes, that he accepted the offer of my assistance. I stared at the man, who'd introduced himself as Isaac Bell. "Forgive me," I said. "I'm not sure I understand. Your employer didn't mention that I'm a private detective."
"No, sir."
"With the Van Dorn Agency. I'm here about the train robbery." The crime had occurred several days after the Grey Ghost was stolen. Three men had been killed, shot by the robbers. A king's ransom stolen, and along with it, the machined engine parts that Rolls-Royce hoped to use to put together a working 4050 engine in time for the Olympia Motor Show. It suddenly occurred to me that one of the dead men had also been a private detective hired by Rolls-Royce to find their stolen car.
"I'm so sorry. This man was a friend of yours."
"I didn't know him, but he was an associate, and I have an allegiance to find out who killed him. I've been hired to find out who killed the three men and who robbed the train."
"Forgive my impertinence, but why am I here?"
"Your employer has offered your services to assist me in my investigation."
"But why?" I asked,
certain there must be some mistake. "I need someone who knows the area. As such, it's important that you tell no one that we're working together. Three men have already been killed. I'd rather not add another to that count."
I wasn't sure what frightened me more, that this Mr. Bell expected me to agree to this working arrangement, or that when he talked about death, the warmth in his eyes turned to steel.
"Why me?" was all I could manage. "I asked for someone trustworthy, but also someone whom no one would suspect would have the nerve to work with a detective."
I couldn't help a twinge of embarrassment over that description. Shadows made me jump. No one would suspect me of having the nerve to do anything remotely brave.
"Perhaps you misunderstood. I'm certain you'd rather have my cousin Reggie. He's the brave one in the family."
"You care about Rolls-Royce?"
"Of course," I said, not fully realizing that Bell had drawn me outside and into a waiting carriage.
"Then you'll do."
Before I knew it, we were halfway down the street when Bell asked, "What do you know about the train robbery?"
The engineers were killed, and a private detective. He was hired by Rolls-Royce. There were engine parts on that train. A feeling of guilt hit me. I ordered those parts. Don't you find it the least bit odd? Surely it was a coincidence. Interesting you'd say that, Bell replied, because that's precisely what I was wondering. Several minutes later, the carriage stopped, the driver letting us out on a street corner next to a brick building about 4 stories high. Bell pointed toward the railroad tracks. That's where it happened. I looked in that direction, feeling slightly nauseated at the thought. If I'm not mistaken, Bell continued, it was just before dawn. The night watchman found a load of lumber spilled at the crossing. A setup to stop the train? I asked. Bell glanced at me. You're a quick study. You'll do just fine. We walked closer to the railroad tracks. The detective who'd been following one of the robbers was killed right here, in the street. Shot in the back. Isaac stared at the ground for several seconds. Then to his right, where wooden stairs led up to a second-story entrance. Which doesn't make sense. By all accounts, he was very experienced. Why? Running for his life. Isaac pulled out a gold pocket watch. What time was the robbery? Just before dawn. I'll see you then.
Well, I beg your pardon?
Here, tomorrow, before dawn. He started to turn away, then stopped. If Mr. Royce didn't inform you, you're not to tell anyone that we're working together. What are we looking for? I asked at dawn the next morning. We were standing at the tracks where the robbery had taken place, wondering who's out at this hour. Besides us, of course. No one that I could see. The brick-fronted factories were dark. We turned right, the streets empty, no sound but our own footsteps. Suddenly, Isaac stopped. Did you hear that?
Hear what?
A tinkling bell, he said. This way. We crossed the street, turned the corner, and discovered a bakery open for business. A bell rang as he opened the door, the scent of fresh bread greeting us as we entered. A gray-haired shopkeeper was handing change to a young woman, who had several loaves in the basket on her arm. Isaac held the door for her as she left, then introduced himself to the baker, asking if any of his customers had mentioned seeing anything out of the ordinary the morning of the train robbery. "Naught but servants out that early," the shopkeeper said. "None mentioned anything to me." We thanked him and started to leave when he added, "Of course there's the boy." "What boy?" Isaac asked. "Caught him digging through the rubbish one morning a few weeks back. So I started leaving the burnt loaves by the door. Make it easier for him, poor lad. A few loaves were missing the day of the robbery. None the next few days. Hasn't been back since." "Any idea where he lives?" Isaac asked. "I'd guess the streets. Skin and bones, that one. Sometimes a younger lad comes with him." The baker showed us the back door that was cracked open wide enough to let out his tabby cat and, next to the door, a wooden crate filled with the burnt bread. I stared at the unappetizing rolls with their blackened bottoms, at once saddened and horrified to think anyone could be so hungry as to dig through rubbish or steal into a shop to take the cast-offs. What I wasn't prepared for was Isaac's suggestion that we come out each morning to wait for the lad. "How will that help?" I asked. "The fact he stopped coming after the robbery is telling," Isaac said. "Perhaps he saw something." We returned the next morning, watching as the baker let out his cat. Then he disappeared to the front of the shop as the little bell rang, announcing the first of an early string of customers. At least we were able to sit in the kitchen near the warmth of the ovens instead of the cold alley out back. On the third morning, after the baker opened the door for his cat, Isaac and I again waited. Just as I'd convinced myself this was a waste of time, a soft scrape outside the door caught our attention. In the shop, behind us, the little bell tinkled over the front door, making me wonder if the sound might scare off whoever was out there.
I started to move toward the back to peer out, but Isaac lifted his finger, urging me to remain where I was. After several seconds, certain that the arriving customer had scared off our would-be burglar, I saw a small hand reach in, grasping one of the rolls. Noting the child's fingernails, curiously clean for so young a thief.
Chapter 22 Oliver cleared his throat as he looked up from the journal.
Perhaps this one starts a little too early. In case you haven't guessed, Reginald Oren had it in for his uncle and was skimming from the orphanage and sabotaging Rolls-Royce by stealing the Grey Ghost. The next journal goes into more detail on how the ghost came into my family's possession, given to us in fax.
That's quite a thank you gift, Remy said. Small, when you think about who Reginald was planning to sell the ghost to.
A competing motor car company wanted the 40-50 plans. They were trying to put Rolls-Royce out of business.
So the Grey Ghost never made the show? Sam said.
No. They put the Silver Ghost in instead, even though the coachwork hadn't been completed. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Imagine, Remy said, sitting on a car that valuable all these years and not even knowing it.
Considering the car's missing and Uncle Albert's accused of murder, Oliver replied, it doesn't really matter at this point, does it?
We're going to find it, and whoever's behind setting up your uncle.
Oliver gave a nod.
Let's hope so.
You were saying something about a reward, Sam said, for the recovery of the treasure. Was it significant?
Truthfully, I have no idea. Why?
Right before we flew out, Selma found some reference to the robbery of the king's treasury. Something about not all of it being recovered.
What rubbish, Oliver said.
Someone thinks that treasure's sitting in the boot of the car.
That? Or the reward you were talking about.
Oliver shook his head. As much as I'd love that to be the reason, I was there when we pulled that car from the barn. The only thing we found was decades of dust.
The possibility exists that someone thinks the treasure's connected to the Grey Ghost.
Well, I suppose it's worth exploring, Oliver said. But the Grey Ghost wasn't the only 40-50 that Rolls-Royce gave out as part of the reward.
There were two other 40-50s included, he said, searching a different shelf for the missing book.
Three, Sam said, looking over at him. You mean there's more than one 40-50 from that time out there?
What?
Well, yes. The Grey Ghost, of course, and two others. One to the American detective, and one to the Viscount's friend, who helped the night they recovered it.
Sam looked over at Remy. We should have Selma look into those other two cars. Maybe there's some connection.
Remy made the call. When Selma answered, she put her on speaker, and Remy caught her up on what they knew so far.
Selma was intrigued. Two other 40-50s, during the same time?
Any chance you know what the value might be? Sam asked.
Not an exact price. More like hot gossip from the London Motor Show. 30 to 35 million was the average value being tossed around.
Laszlo said he heard that if it went up for auction, it might sell for as high as 40 million.
Sam whistled. Quite a haul. Especially if there are two others out there.
Oliver, who was still searching the shelves for the missing journal, nodded.
In fact, they were all outfitted by Barker and Company.
Sam moved to Remy's side, telling Selma, might be a good idea to see what you can find on those two cars. Never know what might turn up.
I'll get on it, Selma said.
Who were the original owners?
A detective who helped with the arrest in '06, Sam said.
The other person.
Oliver's nose was buried in one of the diaries.
I'm just looking it up now. This is the volume after the missing one.
Rather boring in comparison, but it does mention something about the cars.
He turned a few pages, scanned, turned a few more. The writing's difficult to decipher at times. Some of the ink seems to have faded over the years.
Sam looked over Oliver's shoulder, trying to read it himself.
If it's okay with you, we could overnight this to Selma. Let her and her assistants take a look. They do a pretty good job when it comes to restoring documents.
Well, I don't see why not. As long as we get it back.